BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with me, Tony Gosling. As Fukushima joins Chernobyl and Three Mile Island in nuclear infamy, we talk to locals about the nuke station's planned upwind of Bristol, Hinckley and Oldbury. And we ask, what might happen if there's a terrorist attack on a nuclear plant around the Bristol Channel? And when it comes to nuclear power, why are lies and cover-ups the norm? As a handful of UN security councillors declare war on Gaddafi, is it just? And what's the bigger picture? Plus, the Jews have got the Book of Daniel and the Christians a Revelation, but many Orthodox Muslims believe that the wars unfolding now in Pakistan, North Africa and the Middle East were all predicted back in the Quran 1500 years ago, and they expect that Jesus will come back soon, I kid you not, as a Muslim. We hear from Muslim think tank Global Vision 2000, who are holding a mini conference in the House of Lords later this month. But first, Bristol Stop the War have called a demonstration against the Libyan invasion, or not actually invasion, but no-fly zone and attacks from the air tomorrow. Given the likelihood of Britain bombing Libya, Bristol Stop the War Coalition are organising a protest in the centre tomorrow, Saturday the 19th of March, from 2:30pm to 3:30pm opposite the Hippodrome. It's called Hands Off Libya, Don't Bomb Libya, No Foreign Intervention. The lessons of two disastrous wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, they say, have not been learned. The price paid in the devastation of two countries and hundreds of thousands of deaths will now be extended to the people of Libya. Air attacks on Libya will not help and end the civil war, but will escalate it and could be a prelude to a wider war. The approval of the UN doesn't mean that attacks by Britain, France and the USA on Libya are right. The record of the West in the region is of support for dictators with no interest in the fate of the people. Western governments have prioritised cheap oil, arms sales and support for Israel's oppression of the Palestinians above the rights of the Arab peoples. David Cameron say Bristol Stop the War exemplified this approach by touring the region selling arms to dictators at the very moment of maximum repression. This approach has not changed. The clamour to intervene in Libya has more to do with control of that country's oil resources than with support for Libya's people. So, why intervene in Libya and not in Bahrain? The US Fifth Fleet is based in Bahrain. The government of Bahrain is a key ally of the USA, so the USA has no interest in supporting those calling for democracy in Bahrain, where we heard this week that the tanks have gone in from Saudi Arabia and that the army of Saudi Arabia is shooting at armed demonstrators and killing them in Bahrain. There was no call for a no-fly zone when Israel attacked Gaza either, and those Arab governments who just this week sent troops into Bahrain to oppose peaceful pro-democracy demonstrators who have shot unarmed people in the streets have now supported Western military action against Libya. So, Western intervention, we're told by Bristol Stop the War, is at the root of the region's troubles. Disasters in Iraq and Afghanistan should have taught us that military intervention cannot hasten democracy. The future of Libya and the other states in the region must be determined by the people of those countries alone. So, for more independent news and events outlets, please visit the Bristol website or the Bristol Stop the War Coalition. And there are regular anti-war events here in Bristol. A daily Bristol Peace Vigil, which goes on from Monday to Friday from 5 till 6pm outside the Hippodrome, and Saturday from 3 to 4pm in the city centre. If you can only make it for 15 minutes or once a month, they say, please still come. Everyone is welcome. So just to remind you, a demonstration tomorrow, Saturday the 19th of March, 2:30 to 3:30pm, opposite the Hippodrome, against the bombing of Libya. Now, on to Fukushima, and I'm joined by Oldbury campaigner Reg Illingworth, who was on a few weeks ago. Hi, Reg. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello. Good evening, Tony.
And also from Lauren Tobias. Now, have I pronounced that right, Lauren?
Yeah, it's Tobia, but yes.
Tobias. Sorry. Okay, Lauren Tobias. First of all, we're from you, Reg, can you just tell us what stage things are at Oldbury? I mean, you know, I think when we hear that there's a new nuclear power station going to be built. What is the procedure for actually getting it approved, and what stage have we got to so far?
Right, okay. Well, the procedure is quite detailed, actually, and the stage we're at now is that Albury is still deemed to be one of eight suitable sites. We had something called the MPS consultation with Department of Energy and Climate Change, which was going on until very recently. It is now over, that consultation, and we should be hearing within the next couple of months as to whether Albury is deemed still to be a suitable site.
Now, we had Mike Birkin from the Southwest Friends of the Earth in here a few weeks ago, and he was saying that actually one of the things that's brought in with the new Conservative government is that they were actually going to try and make big projects like this easier. Is that true?
Certainly, that seems to be the way things are going, that there's a body called the Infrastructure Planning Commission, which will be changed to the Major Infrastructure Unit. But yeah, the idea is to try and make things easier for large capitalist sort of global companies such as E.ON, RWE, or whoever wants to invest. One issue, can I just explain one issue, actually, with regard to something I've personally heard from a very high-level civil servant. I'll name him. He's Hergen Hay. He's head of the Office for Nuclear Development. And his argument is we should not go too tough on these large companies because they're global companies that can take their money elsewhere and invest for a better return.
Well, a bit like the banks, really.
Yeah. In fact, he actually gave the example as such as China. So, yeah.
So who is this Office for Nuclear Development? It almost sounds like they're there as a part of a government thing to kind of push this forward.
To promote, new nuclear, yes.
Doesn't seem fair, really. Surely they should be taking a bit more of a balanced approach.
Well, yes, this is very interesting, actually. I can't go into too much detail about this, but there was also a consultation about what they call justification for new nuclear. And certainly, from our perspective, we think that justification was skewed.
Now, do you live actually close to the Albury site yourself?
Yeah, I live within 1 mile or 1 kilometre of...
So what's the problem? I mean, you know, when you moved in there, surely you knew there was a nuclear power station site nearby, didn't you?
Yes, I knew that there was a nuclear power station site nearby, but when I moved in, it was due for decommissioning 2 years after we moved in. Now, throughout the whole of the rest of the period, they have been elongating the life by 6 months. Now, fundamentally, that is a very old nuclear power plant. It is older than Fukushima.
Well, one of the things that worries me about this, I mean, having looked into this a little bit in the past, is that when these reactors are built, they're actually built with this primary containment, which is like a giant steel ball around the reactor, and this is designed for a certain shelf life, because as the reactor heats up and cools down, this ball kind of slightly grows and it gets bigger and smaller very slightly as the thing gets hot and then cools down. And there's actually only a certain amount of times that that's supposed to happen, otherwise cracks start appearing in the containment.
Yes, true. And actually, the containment at Albury isn't to as high a level as the containment at Fukushima. Yeah, the actual containment at Albury is less than Fukushima. So yeah, you're talking a major potential issue, but this is all overseen by the Nuclear Inspectorate, so NII. Now, we can only go with their information. It's a bit cloak and daggery, you know? So, but do you believe what the nuclear industry say? They're trying to invest $100 billion in building 8 or 10 new nuclear power sites. Massive potential for investment for large multinational companies. Or, you know, do you believe the government? Because again, as you say, their decisions with regard to justification seem a bit skewed or warped.
Okay, now Lauren, you actually live here in Bristol, so why are you bothered about nuclear power? Because we're actually quite away from Albury and Hinckley, aren't we? We're sort of tens of miles away.
Well, I think the people in Tokyo didn't really think that they were very close to these nuclear power stations either. But I think we're all affected by them. And, I'm very worried.
So what actually prompted you, before the whole Fukushima thing, why did you think, well, actually, this is something that you know, I need to spend a bit of time on? Because for most people here in Bristol, they think, well, you know, it's actually miles away. We don't really need to bother about this.
Well, I'm just...
I think with regard to what Lauren's saying is that we've had access to a drawing on the E.ON website, actually, which is free for everybody to look at. And basically, 35 kilometres radius around Albury would take in the whole of Bristol and going down to South Bristol, Bath. It would take in Newport, it would take in Tewkesbury, Gloucester, and up into the Cotswolds. And effectively, it's a decision that affects a million plus people, million and a half people.
At least potentially. So what, you know, what are your concerns, Laura? Anyway, I want to find out, you know, why you're involved in this campaign.
Well, I just think nuclear power is basically a deadly legacy. I mean, there's still no long term solution to its storage. And why should we create something that we have no idea how to dispose of?
Well, that's interesting, because this is one of the things that they've proved in Japan, is actually these ponds where they store the spent nuclear fuel can be a real hazard in themselves.
Yes, I mean, you know, it's not actually even the main bit of the nuclear reactor that seems to be the problem. It's the supplies to it. So, you know, if you stop the water, how far out do you have to go to be safe? I mean, I just don't feel this is... a safe way of generating energy.
But we're being told by the sort of climate change people and by the government, hang on a minute, Lauren, this is going to be the power of the future. Mm-hmm. And in a way, you're like one of those people back in the agricultural revolution, aren't you? It used to stop the threshing machines. And aren't you being a bit of a Luddite by saying that this technology is actually we don't want it?
Well, I don't think nuclear power is any solution to climate change. I mean, if the nuclear capacity was tripled, it would only contribute 12.5 to 20% of the necessary emissions reductions. And these are European Commission reports. I mean, for every pound invested, 10 times more reductions will be achieved through energy conservation even.
Okay, Reg, what is actually being planned at Albury? What's the scale of the new nuclear plant? And are they going to be keeping the old one, or are they going to be knocking it down and building something new?
Right, okay. Well, to begin with, the old one is what they call 400 megawatts, right? So it's got two reactors, and there's two 200 megawatt reactors. That is due for commissioning. Should have been decommissioned, but because of some sort of policy somewhere, it's been elongated.
Nothing to do with money, then?
I was trying to avoid that word, actually. So that will be decommissioned. But that is going to be decommissioned over the next 100 years. It's not like a 5-minute job.
So you can't just sort of send the ball and chain in and knock the thing down.
But
surely you can just put a bit of earth over the top of it or whatever, and put a warning sign on top of it or whatever.
It's not that, well, certainly it's not that easy. I mean, how many have actually been decommissioned in the UK? None have ever been fully decommissioned because the technology is only 50 years old. But certainly... there's only two or three really that have started.
So they're projecting to build another plant next to the old one.
Projecting to build another one, which will be up to 3,300 megawatts, i.e., 8 times bigger. So potentially 8 times the radioactive capacity.
And what about the size of the site? Because at the moment, I mean, you know, I've been down past Albury, and you would certainly notice it if you're going down the River Severn, but actually from the roads nearby, you might actually miss the thing. You know, it's not enormous. Is the new site going to be bigger?
Yeah, the new site's considerably bigger. I think the current site is 70 hectares. The new site would be 260 hectares. Fundamentally as well, because of, as we've all learned with the Japanese experience, the vast amount of water that's required to cool these things, I think it's 1 million litres per hour. this means that we have to have massive cooling towers that will be built because the capacity of the power station will be so great.
Now, hang on a minute, Reg, because I thought that the whole point of having these nuclear power stations right next to places like the Severn Estuary was that we didn't need to have these giant cooling towers.
Well, you see, the problem is we can suck the water, or they can suck the water out of the river fast enough, but they would be pumping the water too hot back into the river. You would kill off all the fish.
It's a bit worrying, isn't it? So everyone would be able to sort of go and bathe in the Severn. It'd be so warm.
Yeah, well, I must say, I've been to a site called Olkiluoto, which is famous in Europe for being one of the proposed new nuclear sites, which was due to open in 2009 and now may open in 2013. And they do have a langoustine farm there, actually.
What's so, that?
A langoustine farm.
What is it?
Shrimps.
Oh, shrimps.
Shrimps. Yeah, it's like it's like a warm water shrimp. Yeah. So, in fact, there could be some benefits to the local community.
But it's certainly going to be, I mean, if it does get built, it'll be a lot more visible, won't it, from the surrounding area. Yeah.
You'll be able to see it from up on the Cotswold Escarpment, up at Tetbury. You'd be able to see it down in Taunton on off the motorway. You'd be able to see it up towards Tewkesbury as well. So it's vast. It is vast, but it's not just the vastness, it's the horribleness of the whole industry that's a concern to myself.
And now, Lauren, if I can bring you in here, you've obviously been watching what's been going on in Japan over the last week. Just to put aside the terrible human tragedy of the tsunami, what's your assessment, and have you been actually watching it avidly to see what's going on at Fukushima?
I've been basically glued to the World Service all the time I'm working. And it's just worrying because every single day there's another thing. It gets worse and worse, it seems to me. I mean, it starts off with, oh, there's only one problem and all the other ones have shut down, and then the next day it's, well, we've got this happening, and then the roof blows off one, and it terrifies me. Absolutely terrifies me.
And one of the things that's come out, there was actually a fantastic article in The Independent, I thought, this week, on Wednesday. It was written by Michael McCarthy. In fact, the Independent called it a special report. The headline was, a cloud of nuclear mistrust spreads around the world. And this is the sort of thing that bothers me, because what Michael's doing here is he's explaining some of the reasons why that the nuclear industry has been surrounded in secrecy. Is that something that you've come across, Lauren?
Well, I mean, you only have to listen to the news reports to find that the Japanese nuclear industry seem to be giving different assessments by the day, and other countries are also giving their assessments by the day, which none of them seem to be actually joining up and being given the same information. It does depend on which report you hear as to what the scale of the problem is, and so how we as ordinary people listening to the radio or whatever are supposed to find any way through all this information, and whether any of it's right or, you know, who's telling the truth.
One of the things Michael says is that TEPCO, which is the company, the Tokyo Power Company, electric power company that owns the Fukushima plant, has a truly rotten record in telling the truth. In 2002, its chairman and a group of senior executives had to resign after the Japanese government disclosed that they had covered up a large series of cracks and other damage to the reactors. And in 2006, the company admitted it had been falsifying data about coolant materials in its plant over a long period. And on Tuesday evening, it was reported that the International Atomic Energy Agency warned Japan more than 2 years ago that strong earthquakes would pose a serious problems, according to a WikiLeaks US embassy cable, which was published in the Daily Telegraph. Now, this is a culture of secrecy we've got going on here. And I just want to hear from either of you, you know, why you think that is.
I can't really comment too much about
it. Well, I'll go further than that. It wasn't just secrecy. This is lies and cover-up.
Right, yeah. Yeah, well, certainly within the nuclear industry within Europe, I'd say it's a closed shop. It's a massive industry that basically, until now, is dead. But the potential, especially for the French, because the EDF, Energy de France, is a nationalised company, and Areva, another French company that constructs most of these nuclear power stations, have have massive interests in developing this business. They're hurrying around the world, selling them to the UAE, selling them to Kazakhstan, selling them to all these places. Now, I must say, I entrust fairly implicitly the nuclear industry at the lower level in the UK. I think the health and safety people are honest and supervising it relatively well. But then as soon as you get out to China's putting 27 new reactors up in the next 2 years, somewhere along the line, well, this was my argument unfortunately before Fukushima, was somewhere along the line an accident will happen. Now, this is one accident when we've got a relatively small amount of nuclear power stations out there. Okay, they'd say it's an old plant. Accidents happen, no matter what.
Well, the other thing we've got to deal with here in the UK, of course, is the potential threat of terrorism. It doesn't seem like it would take much for a terrorist to actually take out one of these plants. We've got two, you know, very, very close to us. Do you think that's a real possibility?
I do think that's a possibility.
I was looking at the MI5 website on Wednesday this week, and they are saying that there is currently a threat level of severe here in Britain, and that means actually that's only just one down from a critical threat level, which is when you've got an ongoing bombing campaign.
Can I just say there that I through my involvement in Shepherdine Against Nuclear Energy and the Albury campaign, I do get involved to what they call NGO meetings at Westminster, which is where we meet with Hergan Hay, Charles Hendry, who's Minister of State, and a few others, civil servants. And the last one we went to prior to Christmas, security was raised as an issue. And my argument is that, right, we've seen, you mentioned before, Tony, about these ponds, the pools, right? Guy with a cruise missile or a rocket propelled grenade, doesn't have to be too sophisticated, standing 2 or 3 miles away, aims at the ponds, job done.
What are we
really
There's
suddenly a major panic on.
Well, really, you have to do is turn the water off, obviously, from what's happening in Fukushima.
I mean, I think if you're looking at the way that these plants operate, almost anything that goes wrong is likely to actually, potentially anyway, cause something quite serious, because it's quite a critical system, isn't it? You know, unless your water is going in, as you were saying there, Lauren, then it's easy for something to go wrong. Are there any other concerns that you'd like to bring up, Lauren, about the local situation or about Fukushima?
No, I mean, it just worries me that, you know, that nuclear power is a waste problem that's not been solved. I mean, I just don't think it's economically or
this business of the waste. Surely you can just sort of bury it underground or something, can't you?
Well, I think that burying it underground's not really an option. I mean, we have to look at geology, and certainly geology's been quite high up in the latest issue. I mean,
can I just mention
Earth moves everywhere.
Yeah, actually, the government are looking for what they call a volunteer community.
Yeah.
A volunteer community to become, to accept what they call a deep repository, where they'll dig a hole 500 metres deep and put this waste in for the next 25,000 years or whatever. And the only volunteers they've got are up in Cumbria. And recently there was a small seismic incident up in Cumbria, if you may remember. Yeah, it's worth checking out for people, actually.
So, the argument goes that, well, we don't get tsunamis in the Bristol Channel, but we may get terrorist attacks. But you're saying that they're actually, we should be a bit concerned about the possibility of earthquakes too.
Yes,
aren't you just being a bit alarmist? I mean, we've not had hardly any earthquakes in Britain.
No, yeah, all right, yeah, you could say the probability of an incident occurring will be very small, but the consequences of that small risk would be mega. No matter what.
I mean, as we saw last week, actually, this is the biggest earthquake that Japan has ever had to face. In fact, they're certainly by far the biggest disaster in not just in living memory, in history so far. You know, particularly with the consequences of the tsunami as well.
Yeah, but I would say the Japanese are perhaps the leading nuclear power in the world as well. So really, They should be the best people to have designed that plant, to be running that plant, to be maintaining that plant, and even the best, one of the most technological countries in the whole world, second or third biggest producer in the whole world, they can't manage this incident.
I mean, I'm actually going to have a bit of a pop at WikiLeaks now, because I mean, this the way that WikiLeaks have handled all these secret cables is a bit problematic. What they've done is they've given the various bits of information to some of the major newspapers like the Figaro, I think it's Die Zeit in Germany, and the Guardian. They haven't actually simply published them on the web. Now I wonder, maybe if they published this warning about this reactor on the web, maybe it would have got into the press in Japan. There would have been a fuss about it 6 months ago.
Yeah, that could well have been the case.
So why, I don't know, I mean, the thing is, a lot of people seem to think that the WikiLeaks, if you go onto the WikiLeaks site, you can't find all these cables. What they've done is they've given them to the press, to then, and it's up to the press basically to trawl through them. So I would like to have seen them published like Crypto and these other sort of whistleblowing websites that existed before WikiLeaks to have done that. But anyway, what about the public subsidy for nuclear, Reg? Because this is the thing that bothers me. Yeah. I think that potentially this is one of the reasons why there is such a sort of culture of cover-up and secrecy, is because these big nuclear companies are afraid of losing their public subsidy.
Yeah, definitely. Can I just raise one other point about security? Yeah. Really, what I'd like to say is, which perhaps most of the people in the Bristol area certainly wouldn't know, we have 24 armed police based at the Oldbury power station. And when I say armed, machine gun armed, yeah. Now, and that's as a consequence of, I think it was either 2005 or 2007 when we had that terrorist alert. Suddenly we got armed police. It's great for us as locals, you know, because we've got armed police patrolling the area. But why do we need armed police at a nuclear power station?
Well, Evan, you sort of answered your own question by talking about having a possible terrorist attack.
Correct, yeah. So, yeah, but going back to public subsidy, right, public subsidy, yeah. Mr. Chris Huhne, the Liberal Democrat, Secretary of State for DEC, Department of Energy and Climate Change, I think it was in April last year, was a strong advocate against any subsidies whatsoever to the nuclear industry. He saw the nuclear industry as a major cash drain. He's an economist. He was telling everybody how inefficient it would be, how you could do a lot more with energy efficiency. Guess what? 4 weeks ago, he's at a groundbreaking ceremony at Hinkley saying, this is going to be the site of the first nuclear power station. What has happened? You know, the talk about subsidy, I mean, they're thinking about increasing the price of carbon. They're thinking of, there's like a whole schedule of potential. They won't call them subsidies. They'll call them aids or helps or, you know, investment.
This is one of the things that really bothers me, that I mean, you know, you would have thought if you're generating electricity that you can actually make some money at it, but actually one of these nuclear companies are saying is that they can't actually do this without the continued subsidy from the public purse. So why is that?
Because nuclear energy has never been a viable electricity producer.
I seem to remember they tried to privatise nuclear electric at one point, and then I think they only managed to privatise it so long as that the company didn't have to take any responsibility for any kind of decommissioning or anything that happened. So they could basically leave a nuclear power station there, still radioactive, and say, well, okay, it's now up to the public to sort this out.
Well, this is my concern. This is a grave concern for me, that, again, these are multinational companies who have no particular tie to the UK. By the way, E.ON and RWE, who are the site developers at Oldbury, have formed a joint venture company called Horizon Nuclear Power. Could this be a way of them not having to pay liabilities or not tarnishing their brand names if something should happen? I have asked the question. I said, if this site was to go tits up, could Horizon dump the liability? I haven't had an adequate answer to that question.
I'm also worried that you know, nuclear power is also dependent on a limited resource. Uranium, like fossil fuels, will run out, and although the waste will remain for thousands of years afterwards. I mean, it's uneconomic to be spending vast amounts of money on a dangerous technology capable of killing whole cities full of people. Yeah, I mean, it worries me.
But I mean, you know, the alternative surely is things like coal-fired power stations, which actually cause massive amounts of pollution. I mean, this is the whole sort of climate change, the climate camp, and all these people have been saying, actually, we've got to stop coal. So what are we going to do instead?
Well, I think what we really need to do is to look at wind, solar, geothermal, ocean wave energy. I mean, ocean. I mean, we're right next to a massive tidal range, and yet we're still thinking about putting nuclear power stations at the end of our roads, basically.
Now, I've heard talk about Bristol as a place where there's a big tidal range. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, it gets really high tides and really low tides, as far as I can see. And I mean, that means
we get a lot of mud, don't we?
Yeah, we get a lot of in and out and mud. But I mean, you know, that's a lot of energy. That's a lot of energy that could be tapped. I mean, what we really need to do is look at energy efficiency. I mean, we need to switch investments to sustainable and affordable renewable energy. I mean, we're wasting vast amounts of money on this stuff.
Now, these big nuclear power companies aren't going to be very happy with you, Lauren, are they? Because you know, they're actually looking at Britain now, and they're talking about having several new nuclear power stations across the country, and surely they're just going to, and especially now they've got this much easier system for getting their permission to do it, they're not going to stop because you don't like it, are they?
Well, I don't really know what to say to that. I mean,
I think really what it needs is for, and I think this will definitely happen through Fukushima, is unfortunately people will realise the risks involved again. Remember, we're on the 25th anniversary of Chernobyl in April. And remember how many farms in Wales and Scotland had to be closed down. The food, the cattle and the sheep couldn't be moved for a long time. In fact, there are still, if you check out the DEFRA website, there are still 356 farms today in the UK that are suffering from transport difficulties because of Chernobyl 25 years ago. Thankfully for the UK, we are a little bit further away from Fukushima.
Well, one of the other things that is said in this independent article I was quoting is the rest of the nuclear industry has been dissembling for so long and caught out in its lies so often that the chance for trust may have passed. Even if, as I suspect, the Japanese government is trying to be reasonably upfront about the problems at Fukushima, it's by no means certain that anything it says about the nuclear part of their nation's catastrophe will be believed. And that's how he finishes his article. It's actually, you know, one of the best things I've seen on just looking at some of the sort of structural problems, like this desperate need to get a good public image to continue to get the public subsidy. But what about this talk that some people say is that actually that there are military links to this technology? Because we keep hearing this when we're talking about Iran, don't we, and Iran's nuclear power program. Oh, we mustn't let them have a nuclear power station otherwise, because what they really want is a nuclear bomb.
Yeah. Well, definitely. I didn't realise this until very recently, but Tony Benn, obviously an ex-Bristol MP and Secretary of State for Energy, was one of the main proponents of nuclear energy to begin with in the 60s. In fact, I think he actually opened the Albury site. Recently he was interviewed on BBC Politics show on the Sunday, and certainly he was saying that the civil nuclear industry is the main source for materials for nuclear weapons. And if he'd have known that at the time, he said he wouldn't have been so great with the nuclear industry.
Also, when there is already a supply of nuclear material, I mean, it's obviously going to take less time and cost less to start bomb making.
I mean, yeah, it's plutonium, isn't it, that comes from these reactors. Basically, what happens is as the thing reacts away and gets hotter and hotter, these fuel rods get so hot that they then get taken out of the reactor, stuck in a pond for, I think it's about a year, until they cool down a bit. And then you can send them up to Sellafield, and they actually go through Bristol Temple Meads station. So if you ever stood there on a Wednesday, if you ever stood at Temple Meads on a Wednesday and you see some kind of slightly dodgy looking brown train with cream coloured flasks going through, the best thing is to stand away from the edge of the platform. And I can tell you, I mean, we actually did some filming some few years ago for HTV of the train going through, and obviously the nuclear police were onto us, because every time we turned up on the platform, the train would just not come through. Anyway, we eventually got a bit of film. But the thing that bothered me is, even when the when this nuclear train was parked, a couple of, it was actually on the other side, it wasn't right close to me, it was just kind of a little bit further away, you could actually feel the radioactivity of this thing that was heading up to Sellafield. And it kind of, it's like an aching sensation in your bones, and you think, oh God, what is that, you know? And those are then sent up to Sellafield. What happens then with those fuel rods is that the plutonium is extracted from it, and then I imagine this is then sold to the military, who then turn it into nuclear weapons and hydrogen bombs and this kind of thing. So there's definitely a connection. But I wonder, if there was no demand for the plutonium, do you think the nuclear industry would just conk out?
Yeah, I think it probably would, actually. Yeah, I think it probably would. That's the answer to that one.
Okay, now also, for the both of you, could you
just one point I'd like to make about, you know, the nuclear waste situation, actually. The proposals with the new sites is that the waste will be kept locally for 160 years, so you know.
It's not going to be going up to Sellafield.
No, it doesn't.
Well, at least it won't be dangerous as it's being transported.
But then it's more of a target for terrorists locally. You've got, if you think about it, you've got 8 piles of material lying around the country, at least in Sellafield. And I'm sorry for the people of Sellafield, because it's one horrible place to live. It's a beautiful part of the country, but for the price of jobs, they've created one hell of a horrible environment up there.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, they've got a visitor centre. So if you think it's horrible, what they'll do is they'll give you a little sort of a chat through the way it all works and how. I mean, there must be a fantastic amount of effort, though, that is put into safety, Reg.
Oh, there'll be a significant amount. I mean, I've got stories. One of the lectures that we had recently in Albury was about low level radiation and childhood leukemias and cancers. And one of my friends actually lives up in Cumbria, so her sister lost a child to leukemia, and her husband was a subcontractor at Sellafield.
So do you think that there's a real risk to the people living near these stations?
There's a definite risk. There's a study called KICK, which is a German study, Kinder in something, yeah. And they, it was proven that there's a higher incidence of childhood leukemia and cancers around every nuclear establishment in Germany. Right now, the argument is, okay, there's a higher incidence around every nuclear establishment, but was it the nuclear that caused it? That's what the opposition always say to that argument. How can you prove that it was nuclear? Okay, there's a higher incidence where nuclear is. How can you prove it?
Well, I mean, surely it's just basic logic, isn't it?
Well, to normal people who are, you know, you listen to an argument. And the other thing is that because a lot of the places that are chosen to put these sites in, are, in UK anyway, are low-level population areas, the incidence, you know, the probability of a child getting cancer, if you've only got 5 children, say, in a community of 50, is smaller than if it was somewhere else. But As was said at that conference, you know, a pro nuke guy got up and said, well, statistically, the chance is very low. The lady who was doing the presentation, who lost her child to leukemia, stood up and said, showed a photograph of her daughter, who was lost at 8 years old, and said, this is a statistic.
Now, Lauren, can you give us some details of these local campaigning groups, and how did you get involved in this?
I basically got an email calling for help.
And so, yeah, so I know that there is a campaign. I think there's one called Stop Hinkley, isn't there?
Yeah, Stop Hinkley.
I get some stuff on email from them from time to time. And you run something separate up at Oldbridge.
Yes. I mean, Stop Hinkley, very good group, used to be run by a guy called Jim Duffy, who's retired recently. They had another outlet called Shut Oldbury, and... About 2 years ago, we formed our group.
And what do you actually do as a group, apart from send emails to each other and articles from The Independent and all that sort of thing?
Oh, well, we're fairly active. We're not aggressive or anything. We're very... Our membership is very, very nice people, really, but concerned people.
Because I remember last time you were in here, you were organising an event of some sort.
Yes. I mean, over the last 18 months, we've had various events, we've had events where we've projected images onto the town hall in Thornbury and had an awareness raising situations. The one you're talking to, I think we had five professors of various fields about nuclear coming to speak.
So the idea is really just you're just educating local people,
raising awareness. That's what we've done, and at no cost to anybody, people have been able to come up and listen to these guys. These guys come from London or wherever, and basically, some of them don't even charge travelling expenses. They come because they want to get the message out.
And what's the group called again?
Our group is called Shepherdine Against Nuclear Energy. Can I just say that you can also contact us on email. oldburynuclear@btinternet.com. Now this weekend there are a fair few vigils about Fukushima going on around the country. We're not sure if there's going to be one on in Bristol yet, or one even in Oldbury, but if people want to attend something, if they can email us, then, you know, we may well decide to do something.
Now, not everybody has the internet.
Okay. Phone number 07796 447 880.
Well, Reg Illingworth and Lauren Tobia, thank you ever so much for joining us today to inform us about what's been going on round here. And we shall be following the developments at these two potential new nuclear sites around the Bristol Channel with interest on this programme. Now, as Britain's armed forces move to bomb Colonel Gaddafi, it's a good time to remember that his responsibility for the Lockerbie bombing and the murder of PC Yvonne Fletcher is by no means certain. Alan Frankovich's Channel 4 documentary, The Maltese Double Cross, proves the US intelligence service CIA planted evidence at the Pan Am 747's Lockerbie crash site, and also witnesses were bribed and intimidated into the trial of who did it. Another Channel 4 two-part dispatches, Murder in St. James in the early 1990s, also showed that the shot that killed PC Yvonne Fletcher could not possibly have come from the direction of the Libyan embassy, but from a flat that until the day before had been rented by Britain's security service MI5. There's also the fact that revealed by MI5 whistleblower Annie Machon that MI6 paid al-Qaeda in Benghazi hundreds of thousands of pounds to assassinate Gaddafi in the early 1990s. So what's going on? Is it all just about oil and money? Argentina has had a total economic collapse in the year 2000, and Adrian Salbucci is a commentator there who believes the Argentinians have a lot to teach us about the way the world really works. After their harsh experiences with total economic collapse and three presidents in a fortnight.
We have to do a double reading about this. On the one side, we definitely do have the peoples of different countries, of Bahrain, of Iran, definitely of Iraq, of Libya, of Yemen, of Egypt, we've seen it in the last month, who really want to have change. And here I believe that we have to be very careful and adjust our paradigm to the 21st century. It's not so much the United States taking advantage or not taking advantage or being concerned or not being concerned. We have to think in terms of a global power structure that operates inside the United States mainly, but is not a part of the United States even, and definitely does not go in favor of the national interest of the United States. no doubt the United States would like to see regime change in Iran, but at the same time they would like to see no regime change in Bahrain. And in Egypt, they probably knew that regime change was on the way because of the age of Hosni Mubarak. I think that above the United States, above the White House and the State Department, we have to think in terms of the global planning being carried out by the global power elite, particularly the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, and the Bilderberg Group. We are seeing on a planetary basis, on a worldwide basis, how the global power elite is closing the stage of globalization that's been on for the last 20 years, and they are moving on to formal world government. And in that former world government, even the United States has to become weakened in relative terms, just as globalization required for the demise of the former Soviet Union. So in a way, we are seeing the United States also under attack by these global power elites, who probably need a more generalized turmoil in the Middle East, because every time there is turmoil, it is a good opportunity to take advantage, not for the United States, perhaps not for any specific Western country, but for the global power elites' long-term interest. And you can find out much more about those if you look at what the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, and the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London are saying, than listening perhaps too much to the White House and to the State Department.
That was Adrian Salbucci there, talking about what, at least his idea of some of the reasons behind what's been going on recently in the Middle East. Now, Jews have the Book of Daniel and Christians the Book of Revelation, and many Orthodox Muslims believe that wars unfolding now in Pakistan, North Africa and the Middle East were all predicted in the Quran 1500 years ago. They expect Western military intervention in the Middle East will backfire, and that as the bloodshed increases, Jesus may even come back, but not as a Jew or a Christian, as a Muslim. With the support of Muslim MPs and Lords, London think tank Global Vision 2000 have held several conferences explaining what's wrong with our money system. But later this month, they are holding a mini-conference in the House of Lords to look at the unfolding crisis in the Middle East and North Africa. It's called Transformation in the Muslim World.
It's Moin Yassin. I'm responsible for establishing Global Vision 2000. This is our independent think tank in the UK. When I pondered over many years ago what contribution one could make as a think tank, I realized there was need for a new agenda, indeed a new vision, especially moral political economy. Both UK and abroad, there are visions. However, as you know, the shadow world government, the oligarchy, or whatever you want to call it, they do have a vision, and it is to remain in power at the expense of everyone else. So that's a dilemma. So I think we've got to differentiate between those who are promoting British interests as opposed to using number 10 and the other levels of power for the oligarchy's interests. I think that's a very important point to differentiate.
You have an event coming up in the House of Lords Committee Room 4A, on Wednesday, the 30th of March. So what's that about? It's called Transformation in the Muslim World.
We've done other events in Parliament, indeed out of Parliament, before the crash, during and after. This one's focusing on the Middle East for obvious reasons, given the People's Revolutions. We will be focusing on this dangerous and exciting time. A lot is at stake, and we will home in on certain key issues,
particularly in the Middle East at the moment and North Africa. So there's a kind of multifaceted battle going on. What do you think are the main aspects of that?
The Global Vision angle, we are not just an organization that gives a platform to other people. We do have our own strategy and about our own cut on what's happening globally. So maybe I'll start with that. According to Prophet Muhammad, 1400 years, and this is orthodox Islamic thinking, no matter what others may say or deny, the Muslim belief is that the Islamic political state or institution would collapse. The Prophet said the caliphate, which is misunderstood in the West by people like Blair and all the others who demonize it. That was meant to disappear, and it did disappear. In 1924 in Ottoman Turkey. And then the Prophet said to the disciples, they asked what would happen when it disappeared. He said an era of dictatorship would descend on the Ummah, the Muslim nation. And that has so happened. basically the Middle East has been frozen since 1916. That is the reality. And the people have been in a cage. They've been frozen with dictatorships. And the implication of the prophecy is the domino theory, the Islamic domino theory. In other words, what's happening, I believe, will not stop in Egypt or Tunisia, Libya, obviously. And mercenaries, by the way, we've got research on this, that Zionists are also backing mercenaries in Libya. And even in Bahrain, there's evidence that, on the one hand, the Americans are saying, you know, to the Bahraini king, you know, open up. But behind the scenes, they've instructed their clients to go in with the Saudi army. So there's a lot at stake here, but no matter what they do, it is ordained, change is going to come. And currently, they're operating warfare at four levels. Info warfare, the propaganda warfare. They're operating at the cultural warfare with the media and so on. They're operating with the military, obviously, the military-industrial security complex, and that's been on an onslaught with the so-called global war of terror, on terror, but it's actually global war of terror. And what people don't know is there's a global financial and economic war going on. So what we're seeing just now is eschatological, actually. You probably not heard that in the press, because the analysis is very superficial. We are living in extraordinary times. There is a power vacuum emerging in which the people are seeking a new paradigm. And that's why Global Vision's slogan is moving towards the universal paradigm shift. We knew this would happen. This is the dawn of a new age. One of the implications of the Islamic domino theory is that, you know, you've got states like Yemen, very poor country, really. And then you've got states up the road like Qatar, Bahrain, yeah, in a different world. I mean, these borders have got to go. Energy-rich and energy-poor or resource-poor regions of the Arab and Islamic worlds cannot sustain themselves. They have got to dissipate. They've got to the borders, artificial borders, have got to disappear. That is one implication of the Islamic caliphate. Artificial borders which prevent the natural, organic, sustainable community and cultural community and political community have got to go. These borders, it's not just in the Middle East, even in Pakistan. Afghan-Pakistan border was the Durand Line, even in Central Asia. All these borders have got to go.
What we've seen just this week is the Saudi Arabian tanks being sent in to put down peaceful demonstrators. So, I mean, you're saying that you think there's a positive future for the Arab world. It doesn't look positive this week, does it?
Very good point, firstly. Who said that the change was going to be peaceful? In this period of change I mentioned, prophetic change, yeah, there's going to be a Muslim leader appearing. That's the good news, called the Mahdi. And he will ally himself with the second coming of Jesus. Now, people talk about a golden period coming. It will come globally. Jesus will come and be sent as a Muslim, accept the revelation, the truth of it, and ally with the Muslim leader, the Mahdi. And the period that they will eventually bring will be peaceful, just for the whole world. However, the dawn and the transition to it, I personally believe, will be messy, because the global oligarchy has dehumanized the world. There are huge interests at stake, and they will fight tooth and nail and expend bloodbaths, if necessary, to retain power. It's not going to be a bloodless revolution. Some Muslims do, it's nothing new, they have referred to the so-called global war on terror, or as a global war of terror, as a crusade. Indeed, some of the Middle Easterners have got long memories, talking about the Americans, you know, being in the region as the crusaders returning back. I think we've got to have, leaving aside whether they're crusaders or not, is that we've got to understand what has been happening since 9/11. As you know, you've obviously done a lot of work on 9/11, and myself to some extent, is that it's quite clear that the shadow world government and certain of the oligarchy have deliberately gone on the warpath As we know, it's all a fairy tale. Anyone who believes in the official 9/11 theory needs their head examined. I think the more I look at 9/11, there has been Zionist inspiration to it, because that war, whether you like it or not, has led to armies from Christian nations, to put it crudely, secular Christian nations, to go on a warpath. It's been 10 years. And so who benefits? By having Western Christian armies, primarily in Muslim countries, is a Christian-Muslim war to some extent, or it can be interpreted. So one should ask who benefits from that in the region. It's Israel, isn't it?
Well, that's a bit strange, because both Christ and Muhammad were men of peace. Well, why should they be fighting?
Well, I'm not talking about religions here. I'm talking about the labels. I'm just talking about perception. The good news is this whole plan is going to backfire. It is part of Orthodox Muslim belief that Jesus will return, the second coming, and he will come as a Muslim and ally himself with the Muslim leader, the Mahdi. In other words, if the leader of the Christians, yeah, who we respect and accept, maybe not as God but as a prophet, comes back, it means that his followers would have to do what he's telling them. So the plan of the oligarchy is going to backfire. In other words, there's no clash in terms of the spiritual brotherhood, affinity between Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. I was trying to make a distinction between the faiths and those who are using those labels for military, political, economic purposes.
That was Mohin Yassin there from Global Vision 2000, and the conference he's talking about is Transformation in the Muslim World, the Muslim Domino Theory, at the House of Lords on Wednesday, the 30th of March. You can find Global Vision 2000 on the web at globalvision2000.com. Final reminder of the demonstration tomorrow, Saturday 19th of March, 2:30 to 3:30, opposite the Hippodrome. That's all for this week. Sky News at 7 coming up now. Thanks very much to our guests in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Hengrove, Sylvia Dubell, and Conservative Councillor for Stockwood, Dave Morris. If you want any more information about this programme, thisweek.org.uk on the internet. See you next week.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody...